Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hello, I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radio Lab.
We're still talking about numbers, and now we're going to switch, though it may fatigue some of us. If you think about them a little differently, if you learn to embrace them and give them a bit of a hug, wonderful things can happen. I'm going to introduce you to a nosy man named Mark Negrini.
I'm an associate professor at the School of Business at the College of New Jersey.
Has a really heavy New Jersey accent. But what he really likes to do...
What kind of accent was that?
That was kind of a...
I originally grew up in Cape Town, South Africa.
South African, yes.
Oh.
He likes to play detective, and the clues he looks for are numbers.
I can't walk past a number without just wondering about it. What went into that number? How did it get there? For example, after I finished filling up at a gas station, sometimes I would just walk around and look at the dollar amounts on the pump.
So he peeks in at the pump right next door. And
it's rather amazing. You can almost tell who's been there before. If you see a number like $1.40, then you know, oh, teenager with no money.
Why? Wait, explain that?
Because that's all the kid can afford.
Quite right. Sometimes I'll see $10.04 and I'll say, you meant to do $10, but you were a bit slow today.
So you go to the gas pumps and they tell you all little short stories.
Yes.
And his favorite story that numbers tell actually starts back in 1938. So imagine an office.
In Schenectady, New York, at the GE Research Laboratories.
And in that office is a man and he's sitting at his desk.
Mr. Frank Benford.
And Mr. Frank Benford is a physicist, so he's doing some difficult calculations and he's hunched over a book. Probably, actually, one of the most boring books you could imagine.
Yes.
This is a book of logarithmic tables.
What are logarithmic tables?
So, log tables were a very convenient way of doing multiplication in the early part of the last century.
So, remember, this is before there were calculators. So, if you wanted to multiply something like 145 times 3,564, you could just go to this book and look it up. So it starts with numbers you might want to multiply by. 1 to 100 on the first pages, then 101, 102, up to 200 and 300. And the back of the book is like 900. The further you go, the higher and higher the numbers you use to multiply.
That's right.
So our Benford fellow, he's sitting there doing his calculations, and he's looking up the numbers, flipping through the book.
He's staring at the pages, and...
He notices something kind of weird.
He noticed that the first few pages were more worn than the last few pages.
Meaning more smudgy and dark. Colonel Oily, as if he was using the front of the book
more than the last few pages.
And he wondered, why is this happening?
Strange.
I'm not aware of favoring one part of the book over the other. Am I doing something a little odd? Or maybe it's something bigger. And that's when it hit him.
He thought, maybe in this world, there are more numbers with low first digits than with high first digits.
What?
More numbers that start with 1 or 2 than numbers that start with 7, 8, or 9.
Just because his book is worn?
No, that's what started him thinking. So here's what he did.
He compiled some tens of thousands of statistics.
That's Steve Strogatz, mathematician at Cornell University.
Just anything he could think of that was numerical. Molecular weights of different chemicals, baseball statistics, census data.
The revenues of all the companies listed on the main stock exchanges in America.
And everywhere he looked, in all these different categories, it seemed, yes, there were more numbers beginning with 1 and 2s than 8s and 9s.
Wait, really?
Oh, yeah. This has been checked out again and again and again, and it's true.
Size of rivers.
Yeah. Earthquakes and things like that.
Populations or number of deaths in a war. Areas of counties.
Stream flow data.
What if you were to, say, get all the people in New York together and look at their bank accounts?
Bank account balances follow Benford's law nearly perfectly.
Meaning that if you just look in at the amount of money that people have, matter-of-factly, in all the bank accounts, you'll find they begin with one more often than they begin with two?
Perfectly, yes. So actually, they begin with one 30.1% of the time. They'll begin with a two 17.6% of the time. They'll begin with a three 12.5% of the time.
That's a big difference. Why would three be 12? I'm sorry, keep going.
The poor nine would only occur as a first digit 4.6% of the time, which actually would make the one approximately six times as likely as the nine. And it is quite amazing.
That is more than quite amazing. That's deeply suspicious.
I mean, this is crazy what I'm telling you. And I can't give you good intuition why it's true.
But Steve and Mark and many, many, many mathematicians will tell you, despite what you may think, there is a preference, a deep preference in the world, it seems, for number sequences that start with ones and then twos and then threes.
Robert?
Mm-hmm.
So what?
Well, this is not just a mathematical curiosity, Jed. No, no, no. There is something you can do with this information.
What?
Well, when Mark Negrini first ran across Benford's law, he thought, maybe I can use this law to bust people.
For payroll fraud, tax return fraud.
You thought, hey, we can use this to catch a thief?
That's right.
Huh? How?
Well, Negrini figured if you look at a bunch of numbers, say bank statements or expense reports and so on, and you see that the numbers in the business do not match the natural pattern of Benford's law, so the numbers don't begin with ones more than with twos and won't begin with twos more than with threes and so on, then you could say, hey, this is not natural. This may not be true. This may be fraud. So he started giving lectures on the idea that Benford is a way to catch thieves. The only problem was,
they didn't quite believe Benford's law, which means the rest of my talk isn't going to go anywhere.
It is now my great pleasure to introduce you to one of the most fabulous people I've ever had the name to say, Daryl Didoro.
Daryl Didoro.
It's an alliterative heaven.
It's like palindromic.
Yeah, it's Daryl Darrell.
Oh.
Darrell.
Darrell. But I should say, Daryl is, what does he call it? He calls it...
I'm a forensic accountant.
Forensic accountant. Which means his job is to examine numbers and figures to see if someone is stealing.
It's an investigative process.
And while at first he was unsure about Benford's law,
a little bit skeptical,
one day
I happened to talk to one of my neighbors who was a retired statistics professor, and he said, oh, Benford's, I have my students do that proof every year. And he actually wrote out the proof for me, and it's just, it's immutable. It's a mathematical law.
And now it's one of his favorite tools of his trade.
We have a case right now underway, relatively small company. Family shareholders, there are four of them. One of them feels like she has been misrepresented as a shareholder.
Meaning she thinks these other three guys might be stealing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Yes.
And I know you can't tell us what this business is doing, but is it a
regulated business. it's a business that each of you purchase on a regular basis through your local governmental authority.
Okay. Trash collection or sewage.
Recycling.
Sure.
Anyway, this one woman thought she was being cheated.
So she got an attorney involved. The attorney requested data. So we have 7 years of income tax returns.
And that's all he had, just tax returns.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So he entered them all into the computer.
Aggregate them, run Benford's, and boom. Clicked on the graph. We instantly saw, bingo, for a couple of the years coincident with when the dispute began, the way they've reported their taxes violates Benford's.
Very suspicious.
Yes. Blew out the Benford's pattern.
You mean like there were too many nines on the tax returns?
Meaning if you looked at the tax returns of this company, you will see a pattern that isn't natural exactly. Not enough ones and too many sevens, eights, and nines. But now you have to convince detectives and then lawyers and then judges that this is real evidence of wrongdoing, but they've not heard of this thing.
Benford's,
I don't know about it,
as a practical tool, has probably been around maybe 10 years, maybe 15 at the outset.
Please welcome Darryl Correll.
I'm at a conference now with about 700 people.
Nice to see all of you here.
I've spoken four times, and each time I've asked about Benford's, who's heard of it?
Who's familiar with Benford's Law?
Maybe, maybe 5% of the people.
Can you just look at pennies?
Just a couple observations.
To me, it doesn't make sense to exclude the pennies.
Can you use Benford's?
When your same result.
And they're asking, do judges allow Benford's in as evidence that suggests that someone's committed a crime?
Is there case law out there that actually cite the use of Benford's Law?
And Darryl tells them, oh, yeah.
Yes.
You can use this evidence in court.
Yes, federal, state, and local, from the experiences we've had.
And then he tells them stories. Right, like the case of the CEO stealing money to buy
automobiles, firearms, artwork, jewelry, run Benford's, and boom. The CEO is still in federal prison.
Or the case of the dentist and his wife.
She began having an affair with a guy who turned out to be a meth dealer. The dentist suspected her of having dipped into the till. Run Benford's and boom.
Oh, busted.
She eventually pled.
Or the guy with a $40 million Ponzi scheme.
Run Benford's and boom.
Well, almost boom. I mean, Benford's was an element in all these cases. It wasn't the clincher, but still.
It is a very compelling argument. And in 10 years from now, it'll be the equivalent of a fingerprint.
That's it, huh? Well, you still haven't addressed the central mystery here. Why in the world would there be more ones than nines? Shouldn't they be
Equi-coincident?
Yes.
Well, the answer is actually very complicated and deeply mathematical. The simple answer is...
Is there an answer, though?
Yes, there is an answer, and it has to do...
Do you understand the answer?
No. I mean, I understand that it has to do with logarithms and the business of doubling and... the culture of numbers, but if you were to sit me down and say, explain it to me carefully and well, I mean, no, it's just too numeric for me to explain it to you.
Okay, all right.
But I will now take a little sidestep to a group of people who would be able to explain it to us if they were in this room, but we didn't find them in this room. We found them in another room.
We're rarely in the same room that they are, are in.
So let's go with our reporter, Ben Calhoun, and meet a crowd of mathematicians. Ben?
Yep.
You decided to, I don't know, it was some kind of a busman's holiday. You wanted to go to a math conference?
I did. Badly.
And what happened?
Well, I went to CUNY, which is the City University of New York. And it was a math conference called, it was on combinatorial and additive number theory.
Oh, a good time had by all.
Yeah, it goes by the optimistic acronym CANT. So I had heard that if I went to this room... there was going to be a bunch of mathematicians from all over the place.
A mathematician from Sweden attending.
And they would be able to tell me where they taught, what their name was, but they would have this other way of identifying themselves.
Like?
They had this number.
My number is 2.
3.
2?
Yeah.
3. 3.
2.
Mine is 3, actually.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm
nice.
Really excited about it.
What is that, what does that mean? I'm a 2. I'm a 3.
Well, it's an Erdős number.
What's an Erdős?
Erdős is a guy.
Oh.
So your Erdős number is how many steps away you are from this guy, Paul Erdős.
So you're going to tell me his story?
Yep. Are you ready?
Okay.
Let me turn off my cell phone so we don't ruin the best take.
That's Paul Hoffman. He wrote a book about Paul Erdős.
Mm-hmm.
So we start out in Budapest, Hungary in 1913. It's spring. Two math teachers have a son named Paul.
And he had two sisters. They were 3 and 5, and they had scarlet fever, and they died the day he was born. I mean, imagine that. His mother loses her two daughters and gains a son.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she was so terrified after that that Paul would get a fatal disease and die that she didn't let him leave the house, pretty much for the first 10 years of his life. She didn't let him play with other kids, really. Didn't let him go to school. Didn't let him go outside.
Also, when he was 1 and a half, his dad was captured, and put in a Soviet prisoner of war camp for 6 years of his life. So here's this kid at home without other children around. His mother is out teaching mathematics. All the books in the house were math, and he taught himself basically to read by looking at these math books. And he also said to me that numbers became my best friends. So, I mean, here's a kid whose, you know, whole life is mathematics from the beginning.
But let's fast forward. Paul Erdős gets his PhD in his early 20s. This is in the early 1930s. Paul Erdős is Jewish, which means he knows that he's got to get out of Hungary.
And he managed to get to the United States.
But he has to leave his family behind.
When the Nazis moved into Budapest, four of his mother's five siblings were killed. His father died as they were herding Jews and trying to move them into the ghetto, and he only had his mother left.
But she was in Hungary. And in 1941, Paul Erdős was at Princeton University. He was just 27 years old, completely cut off from his family. He was lonely, and he was homesick.
I mean, this guy had no conventional friendships. He had no sexual relationships. His only contact with the world was the people he worked with. I mean, what's remarkable to me is other people who had been through this kind of life experience might have ended up in a mental institution or worse, but he didn't. He turned this sort of inwardness into making mathematics a joyous and social occasion.
He started connecting with people.
I don't get this. Like, what do you mean?
Well, he started traveling. He would hear about somebody who was working on something interesting, and he would find a way to get there, show up at their door, and he had this phrase that he would say, "My brain is open." And he was there to work with them on whatever it was that they were working on. And he just kept moving.
He made a circuit of 25 different countries.
Eventually, he gave up almost all of his possessions, and he became essentially homeless.
He had no home?
He had no home. So everywhere he went, people had to put him up. And as a house guest, the man was an acquired taste.
He didn't know how to do basic things. He couldn't cook. He couldn't even boil water for tea. He could barely change his clothes.
Erdős didn't know how to tie his own shoes until he was 11.
He had some kind of skin condition, so he only wore silk.
Silk clothes you had to wash.
I mean, he went through life this way.
And there was the schedule.
He did mathematics 20 to 22 hours a day.
He'd bang pots and pans around in the kitchen at 4 a.m. because he wanted you to come downstairs and do more math.
So why would anybody want to visit from this guy? This sounds like a walking nightmare. You have to cook for him and stay with him and wash his clothes regardless and tie his shoes.
Regardless of all of it, you wanted him to come see you.
Why?
Because he was just that good.
This was like God coming to visit you. He knew your strengths. He knew how you thought. And it was fascinating to watch him. I mean, there were times, like, I went with him to a math conference. He was there in his hotel room. And at one point, there were like 10 or 12 mathematicians in the room. Some were sprawled on his bed, some were sitting on the floor. And he'd be working with one for a few minutes. And then he would turn to another. And then he'd go back to a third. And he was working simultaneously with all these people on different problems.
Paul Erdős wrote more papers and collaborated with more people than any other mathematician who's ever lived.
He did mathematics with anybody, even if the person was a dim bulb in the world of mathematics.
Now let me just thank...
What's this person do?
This is Paul Erdős on his 80th birthday.
That the only good wish for an old man you can say is the easy cure of the incurable disease of life.
Surrounded by...
a lot of people.
The mathematicians who loved him and put him up in their house.
We want to express all our deep, warm feelings to you. And I want to raise this toast for you.
He was a saint.
A saint?
A saint.
That's Joel Spencer. He's a mathematician. He was also friends with Paul Erdős.
Now that he is gone, I think of him sometimes in a religious context because he gave this faith to those of us that are doing mathematics, which after all is, if you look at it from the outside, it's a little bit of a strange activity while you put this enormous effort into finding these statements.
mathematicians will spend years of their lives trying to prove these things that, you know, from the outside, look totally obscure and pointless.
And yet, it was clear working with him that what we were doing was we were trying to find truth with a capital T, a truth that transcends our physical universe. I think that's the reason why we like to talk about our connection to Paul, because our feeling of mathematics, the feeling for what we want mathematics to be, Paul Erdős was the embodiment of that feeling.
Somewhere along the way, mathematicians started keeping track of their connection to Paul Erdős. And that's what Erdős numbers actually are. If you published a paper with Paul Erdős, your Erdős number is 1. If you published a paper with someone else and they published a paper with Paul Erdős, then your Erdős number is 2, and so on and so on.
So this is like all the people that Paul Erdős in some way has touched.
All the people who are connected to him through their ideas.
There are about 500 people with Erdős number 1 and about 8,000 people with Erdős number 2.
This is Professor Jerry Grossman. He's at the University of Oakland in Michigan. And what he did was he took each ring of Erdős numbers and he charted it out.
Erdős number 3 has about 34,000 people in it, about 84,000 with Erdős number 4, then they start decreasing.
84,000, that's a lot of people. So if you go ring upon ring upon ring and you do the whole deal, like how many people did this man in the end influence?
I think it's about 200,000 mathematicians.
200,000?
200,000. Picture that for a second. It's like a solar system with more than 200,000 mathematicians, all orbiting around Paul Erdős. And your Erdős number is?
1. 1.
Infinity.
Dennis Eichhorn is a number 2.
Your Erdős number is?
2.
I wrote a paper with my advisor and the other students, and she had written a paper with a mathematician who had written a paper with Erdős.
My Erdős number is 3.
Your Erdős number is?
1.
And everybody with Erdős number 1 knows that they've got that post.
Everybody in this room knows their number.
I would be very surprised if there are people who don't know.
Ben Calhoun's Erdős number is 00.5778-B-1 radical 6. Coming up, a story from our friend Steve Strogatz, the mathematician from Cornell, who tells about a friendship he has, a very precious friendship with his math teacher. So it's all about mathematicians, but this is a very unusual friendship.
I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Stick around.
Hi, this is Daryl Durrell. I'm a forensic accountant in Portland, Oregon. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation.
Helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Hello.
William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the N.E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care.
On the web at aecf.org. This is NPR National Public Radio.
That's right, good job. Okay, wait. Come back.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.